Hello and welcome to a sunny yet blustery Cape May beach. On this week's program, we're down the shore. Susan Lewis explores the Cape May Music Festival. We speak with Temple University Professor Brian Simon, author of Boardwalk of Dreams, A History of Atlantic City. Jason Pfeiffer examines Cape May's vibrant theatre scene, and we visit the Noise Museum in Oceanville. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
When you think of the seashore, you might envision sandcastles and seagulls rather than concerts and culture. But as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports, an annual concert series in Cape May is one example of the growing interest in culture and history by residents and visitors alike.
While beach vendors and gift shops are stocking up on rubber sandals, kites, and saltwater taffy, South Jersey's Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts, or MAC, ushers in the summer season with the Cape May Music Festival. It begins before Memorial Day, during what's called the shoulder season. Deputy Director Mary Stewart says that way, residents who work in the summer service industries can take part before their business picks up.
I don't know if it's in the water or sand in your shoes or whatever, but there's always been a vibrant cultural life here.
And tourists have been coming to Cape May since colonial times. Tom Carroll, a vice president at MAC, says that Cape May was the first of the South Jersey beach communities to develop, mainly because it was easy to get to.
The wetlands that separate most of these sandbars from the mainlands were a major transportation hassle when people first started traveling. But you actually could come by coach all the way to Cape May City, since it's really the end of the mainland. Our first hotel opened before the American Revolution. And by about 1815, our tourism business was booming.
Hence, all the Victorian architecture we see in Cape May, with pointed arches and porches with spindlework. In fact, the entire city of Cape May was declared a historic landmark in 1976, with over 600 protected buildings in a one-mile radius. Like all shore towns, over the years, Cape May had its economic ups and downs. But in the 1970s, urban renewal efforts begun the decade earlier picked up steam. That's when the Emmeline Physic House was scheduled for demolition. Mid-Atlantic Center's Deputy Director, Bill Tenike, says that a group of concerned citizens ran for city council to save the historic house.
The people who got themselves elected to city council actually purchased this house from the developers, formed the Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts, and leased it back to the Mid-Atlantic Center for a period of 75 years. That's how this house got saved.
The property now includes the Physic House, which is a Victorian house museum, outdoor grounds, and a Victorian-style carriage house with a rotating exhibit gallery, which this summer features an exhibit on the 1950s doo-wop era design and architecture. Activities at Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts have expanded to include the maintenance of the Cape May Lighthouse and walking and trolley tours of the historic district. Tom Carroll, who also happens to be a retired Coast Guard officer, says that all this activity wasn't part of any grand plan, but one rescue in the name of history led to another.
We started to only save the Physic Estate, but then we found a lighthouse very much in need of help. We wanted to encourage theater, music, off-season activities. We kind of became a chamber of commerce, a city promotion agency. If we saw a need, we jumped in to fill it because they all work together to promote our common cause.
The common cause includes the celebration and promotion of culture in the county, and this is where the Cape May Music Festival comes in. MAC's Deputy Director Mary Stewart says that the concert series, now in its 17th year, includes not only classical music, but a series called World Traditions.
Under that, we would do Irish music or klezmer music or tango. We've done flamenco. We've done Italian opera. We always do a jazz piece. Sometimes it's classic jazz, Chicago style or New Orleans style. Sometimes it's Latin jazz. So the World Tradition is the diverse programming of the series.
There's no fancy performing arts center, so concerts are held in Cape May's convention hall and church and school spaces. Jed Galen is the music director of the Bay Atlantic Symphony, now in its fourth year at the festival. He says that these smaller spaces create a greater intimacy between audience and musicians.
When you perform in a more intimate space, it gives you the opportunity to really explore each musical gesture fully and also the obligation to do it, because we feel the contact with the audience.
And of course, what the city lacks in state-of-the-art concert facilities, it more than makes up for in seashore ambiance, something that Galen says only enhances the music-making experience.
There's just a different atmosphere, and that atmosphere gives people, I think, a heightened sense of joy with what they're doing. I mean, you walk in a town where everyone's so gracious, where it's so beautiful with the seaside there, and of course you feel inspired by that.
The Bay Atlantic Symphony's programs this year include, among others, works by Brahms, Beethoven, Mozart, and Dvorak, and Carl Goldmark's violin concerto with soloist Hilary Hahn. Other artists appearing in the coming days include the Atlantic Brass Band, the New York Chamber Ensemble, the Pablo Ziegler Trio, the Dennis de Blasio Quartet, and Metropolitan Klezmer, performing Yiddish musical variations in folk, swing, and tango styles. So at the end of the day, after the seagulls retake the beach and the sun sets over the bay, you may well hear the singing of strings, or the wail of a saxophone, or even the shouts of a big brass band.
The Atlantic Brass Band, ending that report by WRTI's Susan Lewis. Cape May Music Festival continues through June 18th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Temple University history professor Brian Simon has recently been the subject of much national media attention for a book he's writing about the coffee shop chain Starbucks. His first book, Boardwalk of Dreams, Atlantic City and the Fate of Urban America, received similar national attention. During the first half of the 20th century, Atlantic City was the nation's most popular middle-class resort, the home of the famed Boardwalk, the Miss America pageant, and the board game Monopoly. By the 1960s, it had become a symbol of urban decay and blight. In his wide-ranging book, Simon does far more than tell a nostalgic tale of Atlantic City's rise, near death, and reincarnation. He turns the depiction of middle-class vacationers into a revealing discussion of the boundaries of public space in urban America. Brian Simon came into our studios recently to talk about Boardwalk of Dreams. Of all the Jersey Shore towns, how come Atlantic City ended up with this amazingly storied history? How did it start off and how did it achieve such popularity at an early stage in the basically in the vacation industry?
That's actually a pretty simple question. It's one of proximity. Atlantic City was the closest place between Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore, and railroad developers pulled out a map, drew a line, and decided where it was going to be. So It wasn't happenstance, it was geography, and then things took off.
And how did things take off?
Well, Atlantic City starts basically as a speculation move. In the early part of the 19th century, as America industrializes and produces a fair amount of wealth, people start to vacation. And they started to go to Cape May. And developers recognized that a group of wealthy people were going to Cape May, and they were going in carriages and things like that. And they decided that if they could lay railroad track, they could create a shore town more for the masses. And that's exactly what happened. It was a speculation bid by boosters who laid railroad track between Philadelphia and Atlantic City and decided that they might start excursions for the developing middle class, not necessarily the working class, the developing middle class of booming Philadelphia.
And what was there to meet them when they went there on these day trips or sometimes weekend trips by rail down to Atlantic City?
Well, at first, not much, except some greenhead flies, if you've ever been to the Jersey Shore, which are particularly nasty. But pretty quickly, there was a hotel, and then there was a restaurant, and then another hotel, and a railroad station. And not long after that, the first boardwalk. In order to make, I mean, lots of the reasons why they went was a perception in the 19th century, and not entirely inaccurate, that cities were dangerous places for people's health. And they were. They were polluted, grimy, disgusting in some ways. And the idea was that a day at the beach would help people physically. And one thing they tried to do was there were all these briars and thickets sort of stopping them from getting to the beach, and they just laid down some boards that people could walk and look at the ocean. And it became remarkably popular almost immediately as a promenade itself. And eventually they caught on to it, and they raised the boardwalk up and then built amenities around it so that the boardwalk became almost more the attraction than the sea itself.
The casinos were to come later, but the great entertainment that was down there, there was a lot of great jazz musicians. The Rat Pack spent time down there and entertained in the hotels. You describe in your book the fact that Atlantic City, pre-1960s, was effectively a Jim Crow town.
Well, those are two stories, but they're closely related. Atlantic City becomes, I think, really quickly, at least by the turn of the century, almost Disneyland before there was Disneyland. Before the Rat Pack came, you know, not even Guy Lombardo, but Armstrong came, John Philip Sousa.
Right.
Came.
Oh, of course, yeah. So, and would regularly bring his orchestra there to stay for some...
For almost a whole summer.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really the first great middle-class resort in America, and masses of people came. The buildings were much more, I think, fantastic than Disney would ever create. Maybe not as fantastic as Coney Island, but truly a kind of wonderland at the beach. Now, in order for that to happen, and this is a kind of key point to me, the town had to be segregated. It couldn't, in early America, attract the masses without keeping some people out. You couldn't demonstrate your middle classness, your inclusion in America, and for some immigrants, your inclusion in whiteness without keeping African Americans out. So the segregation of Atlantic City was not incidental in any way. It was, in fact, the precondition for the city's emergence as a mass resort. Now, this is also really important. African Americans were segregated in where they lived and where they worked, but they were put on display. African Americans were used in Atlantic City. Much of the entertainment was blackface, minstrelsy, which was the kind of staple of vaudeville until the 1950s. But also African Americans were put on display as bellhops, as shoe shiners, and most importantly, Atlantic City, they pushed people down the boardwalk in rolling chairs, these sort of chariot-like
wicker chairs
down this flat, easy-to-walk boardwalk. Now, all of this was to demonstrate to the middle class that they had made it in America, made it like the rich so that they could dominate and hire and control African Americans. And Atlantic City offered that spectacle of fantasy but also racial dominance at a relatively cheap price.
Ironically, then, it was the 1960s and the Civil Rights Movement which was to be the undoing of Atlantic City as this type of resort. Can you talk about how the city's popularity then decreased as African Americans started to gain civil rights?
In a kind of cruel irony, and an irony that gets played out again and again in the United States, desegregation leads to the collapse of places. In other words, once places get too democratic that anyone can go, the middle class, largely white, flees. And what happened in Atlantic City is that as the civil rights movement happened and as public spaces across America, and I think this is an important thing to recognize, that segregation was a national phenomenon and desegregation was a national phenomenon. But as America desegregates in the 1960s, as places become open to anyone, what happens is you have white flight. And we know this story in the suburbs and in the cities. Well, this happens in resort towns as well. When African Americans who themselves want to share in their newfound benefits of better jobs, better access, come to Atlantic City to imitate, you know, immigrants from 50 years before, immigrants see them, and not everyone, but large numbers of them just leave.
We have then a city in decline between the late 60s and the coming of the casinos in the late 70s. Was it not the case that local officials believed that bringing gambling to Atlantic City would reinvigorate the city as a whole and helped to bring about the revitalization of its various neighborhoods?
No, I mean, Atlantic City was, as you pointed out, a place with what people have called urban villages, little cities within a city. And some of those, like Ducktown, survived all the way till gambling came. And the night that the gambling referendum passed, people literally danced in the streets of Atlantic City. The bars, it was a chilly kind of one of those like damp, cold nights in Atlantic City. But bars still threw open their doors, gave away drinks because they believed that yesterday was going to come again. And most of those, some of those promises came true. But for the city itself, it's been largely eviscerated by gambling as a place to live, as a place to work, as a place of culture. For the residents of the city, that city doesn't exist so much anymore.
And why is it then that gambling hasn't, in your opinion, helped to reinvigorate the local economy through this kind of trickle-down economics?
Well, it's not just that. I mean, in terms of urban form and amenities, gambling's been a kind of bust. I mean, if you look at it, 200 restaurants have gone out of business since the casinos came. Until last year, Atlantic City, which once had 15 huge movie theaters, didn't have a single movie theater despite attracting 35 million visitors a year. It has a beautiful baseball stadium on the bay that barely can get 1,000 people a night, despite, you know, being a kind of really wonderful place to watch a baseball game. And why is that? That's because gambling is fundamentally opposed to what we think of as city development. Casinos are in the business of locking people inside and taking all their money. I mean, I'm not suggesting this is a shakedown, but that's what they do. What cities thrive on is that trickle down from businesses that would, you know, go to the local bar, would go to the local corner store. But again, gambling as a principle is meant to lock people inside. And that's why you can have this tremendous development at these 12 casinos and very little trickle down to the rest of the city because of the way that's supposed to work.
Brian Simon, Boardwalk of Dreams, Atlantic City and the Fate of Urban America is published by Oxford University Press. For most major theaters, the arrival of summer means the end of the season, and over the next month, regional companies will stage their final productions and begin looking ahead to a new lineup of works in September. But this doesn't mean that theatergoers won't have the opportunity to catch some shows over the summer months. In Cape May, a new season of theater is just beginning. Now WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer has more on the vibrant theater scene on the southern tip of New Jersey.
South of Atlantic City, there's not much professional theater along the shore. In fact, it's virtually non-existent, with the exception of Cape May. Perhaps best known for its ubiquitous Victorian architecture, the beach town is home to two established theater companies. Founded in 1980, the East Lynn Theater Company specializes in producing American stage classics. Gail Stahlhuth is artistic director.
Theater in Cape May is definitely thriving. Our audiences were up 30% last year over the year before, and already we've sold a good deal, many subscription tickets.
The other theater in town, the Cape May Stage, is led by artistic director Michael Carlton. He's also upbeat about the state of theater in Cape May.
This is our 18th season, and for the past 5 years we've experienced phenomenal growth. We've basically almost doubled our attendance and box office in the past 5 years. And every year we're able to do slightly bigger productions, pay the artists a bit more, and our audience base has steadily increased.
Demonstrated by the success of the Cape May Stage and East Lynn, there appears to be an appetite for theater at the shore. But with so few professional theaters along the southern New Jersey coast, how did Cape May come to support two companies? 83-year-old Bruce Minix was mayor of Cape May from 1972 to 1976. The retired television producer, writer, and director remembers the days when movies were about the only form of entertainment in town, besides the beach.
If you had lived here in 1968, when we moved here year-round, it was a desert. We needed something. We needed it for ourselves. And I think that's still one of the factors that's controlling all of this, because the people who move to Cape May and decide they love it and decide they want to stay are generally fairly sophisticated people, and they're used to having good entertainment.
In many cases, cultivating sophistication involves money, and Michael Carlton frankly admits that Cape May tends to attract wealthy residents.
I think there's a bit of money coming into here. The real estate prices have skyrocketed. It is, you know, probably one of the most expensive places around here to buy property. Because of that, I think people tend to associate, you know, money and culture. I mean, it shouldn't be that way. Everybody should be able to have theater and arts and music and film festivals, but it doesn't really follow.
As a nonprofit organization, Carlton's Cape May Stage doesn't generate very much revenue with ticket sales. In fact, like many theaters, over half of the company's budget comes from grants, private donations, and corporate sponsors. Carlton suggests that few vibrant theaters pop up in the region because they need the support of businesses, which aren't in abundance beyond a shore town like Cape May.
A lot of South Jersey is rural and agricultural, so you don't have anybody to pick up the tab.
While attendance numbers are up and donors continue to support the Cape May Stage and the Eastland Company, it is by no means all smooth sailing for the theaters. For years, one of the biggest hurdles has been the lack of venues. In general, artistic performances in the area take place in churches, hotels, and gymnasiums. The Cape May Stage is finally in the process of converting an old church into a more conventional theater space. Renovations are slated for completion next year. But Gail Stahlhoff says the East Lynn Theater Company, which performs in Cape May's First Presbyterian Church, hasn't had such luck in securing their own space, although they've come close in recent years.
And it's broken my heart several times to come close, but, you know, real estate by the shore is very expensive right now. We have not given up, and in the meantime, we've actually had other venues be known to us that are outside of Cape May County and outside of Cape May. And the decision so far from the Board of Trustees of the East Lynn Theater Company is to try to keep finding a place here. So in essence, we have turned down other venues at the risk of staying here and still hoping to find a permanent home.
The difficulty of finding a good performance space is one downside to doing theater in Cape May. However, the nearby beaches and surrounding Victoriana might make up for that inconvenience. Michael Carlton says the shore culture helps to pull in good acting talent from Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, and even the West Coast.
I think a lot of these really, really fine actors come here because they know we do good work and they know they get, you know, their days off at the beach. They'd call me up and say, hey, you got something for me this summer? I'd love to be down at the beach for the summer. And I'm in a really lucky position that I know a lot of good actors who do want to come here and work for much less than they're worth.
While the beach and Victoriana make Cape May an easy sell during July and August, former Mayor Bruce Minix says town leaders long ago recognized that in order for Cape May to thrive, they needed to find ways to draw visitors outside the traditional beach season.
A big element of that, of course, is the theater.
Indeed, the Cape May theater seasons extend from May to December. In conjunction with events like Victorian Week and a film festival in the fall, the theaters proved to be assets for Cape May. But Michael Carlton notes it's not realistic to think of theater as being a primary incentive for most people to visit, for now.
Down in the shore, it's still the beaches, and in Cape May, the Victoriana. But I think we're beginning to be part of the reason people come. And I want to position the arts, and my theater in particular, as a reason people get here.
As theater pickings become more slim in larger cities over the summer, and as the Cape May theaters remain among the few companies along the Jersey Shore, this goal to make Cape May a theater destination might not be too far out of reach.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. K2, the first show of the season at the Cape May Stage, has just opened, while the East Lynn Theater Company begins its season on June 21st with Two Headed. For those in the mood to look at art, seashore shops and galleries show plenty of beach scenes and seascapes. But if you're willing to venture inland just a bit, there's a fully-fledged art museum waiting. Just 15 minutes from Atlantic City, nestled next to the Edwin B. Forsyth Wildlife Refuge, is the Noise Museum, which has nothing to do with sound. It's Noyes, N-O-Y-E-S, named after its founders, Ethel and Fred Noyes. The wildlife refuge is a haven for bird watchers and the perfect backdrop for this picturesque museum. Built in 1983, it feels more like a well-designed vacation home. A wall of glass frames the lake like a work of art, and the sun streams in from the skylight, giving the room a healthy glow that many sterile, boxy museum spaces lack. The founders, Fred and Ethel Noyes, started out with an antique shop. After some success, they began collecting very large antiques. Over time, they purchased old buildings and moved them onto their property, creating a kind of quaint historic village. In 1974, they sold this cluster of buildings known as Historic Smithville for no small sum.
And it is common knowledge that the proceeds from that sale netted $7 million.
Gay Walling is the executive director of the Noyes Museum, which was created with the proceeds from that sale. Historic Smithville Village still stands about a mile away. The Noyes Museum collects and exhibits American fine and folk art, with a heavy focus on artists from New Jersey. Fred Noyes was an artist as well as a collector of hunting decoys, which are considered a sort of folk art.
In the early years of the museum, his large collection of hand-carved bird replicas was on permanent display. As the museum's general collection grew, the decoys were put in storage and brought out every couple of years. This summer, in an exhibition titled The Art of Decoys Revisited, Fred Noy's collection is on view once again, alongside contemporary installations, prints and photographs that pay tribute to the idea of decoys, whether taken literally or figuratively. Museum curator A.M. Weaver says she gave the artists a simple mandate.
To present works that relate some way to the concept of decoy or the term as it's defined as a verb or a noun.
The results include some humorous works, such as a duck made from duct tape, and some pieces of international acclaim. There are prints by Jasper Johns presented as decoys of his original paintings. They are aptly entitled Decoy 1 and Decoy 2. Other artists use the decoy concept even more loosely, with some creating works as lures for art aficionados.
A lot of artists are using it as objects or installations that will attract the visitor. So rather than the hunter attracting a duck, it's the artist attracting the audience.
And the Noy's Museum is ready for that audience. As Gay Walling explains, the fact that the museum sits in a quiet, picturesque setting is both a perk and a problem.
A struggle is our visibility because we are set back off of the main route, even though we're within walking distance of Route 9. There are signs, you know, directing you here. It's still a location that you don't happen upon.
For those who do hunt it down, the Noy's Museum offers an aesthetic change of pace from the sun, sand, and the boardwalk glamour. The Art of Decoys Revisited runs through August 2nd. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Karen DeRosa, Marjorie Preston and Hillel Hoffman. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.